Well, the first full day of summer here in North America is also Make Music Day around the world. A story in the New York Times says more than 700 cities in 120 countries mark Make Music Day. The event's website says it's not a typical music festival. It's open to anyone, anywhere, young, old, amateur, professional, you name it. And where doesn't matter too much. Just make music wherever you are, streets, parks, porches. And Make Music Day apparently has its origins in France, where it launched in 1982 as the Fête de la Musique. And I see around 40 U.S. cities where it's being marked. There's one in Michigan, in Detroit. So Detroit, in somewhere in Detroit, they are marking Make Music Day here on the first full day of summer. Its current state, I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to our program. The associate publisher of the Lansing City Pulse, Mickey Hurton, has been thinking a lot lately about placemaking here in mid-Michigan. His recent writing for the paper and for the Greater Lansing Business Monthly has focused on projects like the outfield apartments at the downtown Lansing Baseball Stadium, Cooley Lawfield Stadium, and expected developments like a new Costco store. Could these projects be a catalyst for more growth in the Lansing area, the kind of growth that leaders of local units of government and business leaders have been striving for? Well, we've invited Mickey back to Current State to talk about how these efforts might be or might become related. Welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. And I will, now that I know it's Music Making Day, I'm going to go home, play the piano. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, it's a, well done. I've heard you play the piano. You can play the piano, yeah. Well, your column in last week's City Pulse was entitled Baseball and Bands, as it turns out. You write about how the Lugnuts and the live music that are on the schedule at Cooley Law School Stadium have spurred the outfield apartment complex. So let's start there. You looked around the outfield. What'd you make of it?
Well, you know, it's funny. Ever since they announced that project, you thought about it, and that they've built it. Every time I go by, I'm trying to keep my eyes on the road, but I was looking at the project off to the side. So finally I said, well, you know, I really ought to go inside and take a look, because I'm sure people wonder what it's like to live overlooking a ball field.
Exactly.
And it is pretty cool. It really is. And it's got, they had, you know, you have the ball games, you have the fireworks, and then they had a big country concert last weekend or the weekend before. And it just struck me that this is precisely what Lansing's looking for. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lansing is transforming in so many ways. And it you know, if it was a stodgy city before, now it's starting to get a little bit of cool in lots of different areas. And what got me thinking more about that was I talked to Thomas Glossmacher, who's head of the FRIB, and he was talking about recruiting. And he talked about the things when he tries to get people from the East Coast to the West Coast or Chicago to come to Lansing, in East Lansing, one of the things they look for are amenities. And it's things he mentioned like Whole Foods or Monticello Market or Old Town. And these things matter. They really do. So, and also happening lately is Costco coming here. Now, I think that's a big deal because Costco is the premier, you know, warehouse retailer in the country.
Have we hit some other kind of level here lately? It seems to be concentrated into a pretty short period of time, the Whole Foods, the Costco.
Right.
Chick-fil-A. I mean, I hear people talk about Chick-fil-A even coming to town. You know?
But I don't know if anyone's coming from New York City to catch the Chick-fil-A, but it all is part of, to me, a maturing of the Lansing area. We are now, I think we have moved ourselves up from a grade, let's call it a grade C+, to a B market. And these things are really important. It's you see it when you go downtown on a weekend night. And the downtown area around the stadium, up and down Michigan Avenue on Washington, it's crowded. There are people there. And if you talk with any economic development folks, and particularly the ones at LEAP, placemaking is so vital to an area because there's so much competition. If you want to get talent, you want to bring young people in, you want to have a dynamic environment, you need amenities that they like, and we're getting them.
Yeah. What's it like to be in an apartment in the outfield, on the fourth floor? It's four floors,
Four
right?
floors, yeah. And, of course, now Pat Gillespie, who built it, his biggest regret is he didn't put on a fifth floor.
How about that?
But who knew? You know, they're small, but they look right onto the ballpark, and they're very modern in their sense. I mean, they're really, although they have a broad clientele, you know, they have older folks, They have doctors. They have professionals. It really has a millennial feel. And so they're relatively small, well-appointed, nice kitchens, nice bathrooms. But you're buying a lifestyle. You know, where else can you get an apartment that also provides half a year of entertainment? And now you have to like the entertainment. And my question, I have a friend who lives there, and that's what got me thinking about this too, is, yeah, it sounds really cool right now. You know, oh, we got games, we got fireworks, we got lights. But when the season starts in April, you know, is that going to get a little tiring by August?
Fireworks are routine. The games run kind of late sometimes.
Well, then the lights are on until 1 or 2 or 3 in the morning as they clean up. But here's the point. You may get tired of it, but there's going to be someone else who thinks this is just the coolest thing in the world. And you see that. So if you go by there on a game night or the concert, the balconies are filled with people. Mm. You know, it is party time. And so it's fun. But it's important because it's a different kind of Lansing than we've had 10 years ago.
What were the ingredients in that, though? What made these things happen?
Well, a lot of it has just been that there's been a push to bring housing into downtown Lansing. And that's in its gone fits and starts. The Gillespie Group has built the Marketplace, Midtown, the Outfield. You took lofts on Washington. And it's the slow growth. I mean, there haven't been any home runs necessarily, but you're seeing it. And the biggest project underway right now is that Skyview, right opposite, right by the Sears.
Red Cedar Renaissance, across from what will be the Red Cedar Renaissance.
9 stories, you know, mixed use. And again, this is part of it. It's happening. But all of these projects together, you know, they bring in housing, they appeal to the right kinds of demographics, they improve Michigan Avenue, and it's just building the kind of corridor that the region needs. And when Red Cedar finally gets off the ground, and they're hoping to break ground this summer, then you will have very significant development pulling East Lansing and Lansing together, but with cool things in between, and that's what they really need.
Hmm. Mickey Hurton is associate publisher of the Lansing City Pulse. He also writes for the Greater Lansing Business Monthly. We're talking about placemaking. Tell us more about the conversation with Mr. Glassmacher over at FRIB.
Well, that's interesting because I'm writing a story this month about the accelerator industry and our bid to build an economic foundation on that. The FRIB is unbelievable. I mean, it is going to be the top cyclotron research organization in the country. So what business leaders in the community are trying to do is build an industry around that. LEAP has developed an entire strategy. They built a 124-page report that goes after this, and they think there's billions of dollars in potential investment if we can lure them to Lansing. Now, one of the things that Glassmacher is talking about is trying to get really good people here. A larger issue is we have some very, very, very deep strengths, but we don't have broad strengths in attacking that. Mm. And that's one of the challenges that the market bans. They have to find broader skills that allow us to compete with places like, the San Francisco's and San Jose's and even Rochester, Minnesota's. I mean, there's a whole base of skills. Our strength is manufacturing. And the heavy, heavy expertise in, you know, nuclear physics that would come out of the university here. So they're building it, and the regional leaders are pretty optimistic. And Glassmacher is out there getting people.
Yeah.
And I talked to him. He was, he was supposed to call me, and he was late calling me because he was working a guy from Chicago who he was telling about the cool things here, the Whole Foods and the Monticello's and the Horrocks and all. So.
Let's really switch gears here. You have recently laid some criticism on the secrecy of the process that was used by county judges that led to the choice of Gretchen Whitmer as interim county prosecutor. You see a lack of transparency here.
They had an opportunity. This is like so much, Mark. I mean, yes, law allows you to do things in secret, but you don't have to. You know, it's like all of the FOIA. You can hold it back or you can give it. So the judges then took an elected office. I mean, that's the prosecutor. And they picked Whitmer, which is a great choice. But why the secrecy? And they had no good reason for it. And it's just, it's sort of, I think the judges sort of confused their judicial role, which is what they mostly do, with sort of a legislative, more a legislative type of role. And they went to their normal judicial secrecy, but they didn't have to. And again, in a something is, there is no more powerful position in a community than the prosecutor. They have dozens and dozens of lawyers. They can charge anything they want. It's a very, very highly politicized elected office. And so you'd think understanding that, they would have said, well, maybe we ought to be a little more transparent in how we operate.
This
but they didn't have to.
It is interesting because yesterday we heard from Ronna Romney McDaniel, Michigan's Republican Party chairman, press release reading she called on ex-state Senator Gretchen Whitmer to voluntarily release all emails and other documents related to her secret selection. It says here is the next Ingham County prosecutor. So, and she points out here in the press release, this is, again, from the Michigan Republican Party, Whitmer told the Lansing State Journal when she applied for the position that it strikes me that one of the most important things to earn back is the trust of the people of Ingham County and Romney McDaniel and the other Republicans are jumping on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty laughable, isn't it, considering the Republicans' interest in open government is about zero. But, yeah, and Whitmer, I mean, this is a short-term appointment anyway, and Whitmer's a good choice. And, in fact, she really didn't push much for it. I mean, the judges, I mean, look at their Democratic court. She is the former Senate Minority Leader, an attorney, I mean, working with a big firm. It's a reasonable choice, and I think there's a little bit of...
You think she should release the emails?
Well, probably. It probably is boring as, you know, can be. I mean, there's really not much there. The judges, when I talked to some of them about this decision, they really didn't give it a ton of thought. I mean, it was just sort of, we need to fill this job. Whitmer's available. And it didn't go much beyond that. They didn't even do interviews with her.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I think that's just, you know, politics in a slow political season.
Let's continue on this theme, though. Your June 8th column about the congressional campaign of Melissa Gilbert was headlined, Another Dem Disaster. You questioned if she was ever serious about waging a campaign to unseat Republican Mike Bishop. She cited health issues in withdrawing. What do you think lay ahead here for the Dems in the 8th?
A disaster yet again. I mean, there is no bench. I mean, look at the middle part of the state. I mean, there just is not a serious Democratic Party operation here. You've got Wahlberg, you've got Amash, you've got Bishop. I mean, these are the congressmen who sort of fringe the Lansing area.
Molinar, yeah.
Yeah, all yeah. Republicans with no one really to step up. I mean, if you think about the Republican bench in this region, you got Virge Bonaro, pretty serious, you know, ran for governor, and you got Gretchen. And after that, I mean, yeah, you've got some pretenders, but...
Verge has aspired to higher office, as we all know. I mean, what are the odds there, do you think?
Pretty slim, I think, because the Dems haven't really put much money into a race here, and it's a tough... You know, I think Bishop could be beatable. I mean, you haven't heard much from him. He's really very much a backbencher. And this was a year with good money, good candidates... I think Bishop might have been, you could at least make it competitive. But
somebody's name's going to end up on the ballot. The money on you?
Well, it could be you or me. I mean, bro, because whoever it is, I think it's likely to be a very sacrificial lamb. And even, you know, this has sort of been the races in the past. But we recognize now, and the Democratic Party recognized it too late, that it got completely outmaneuvered using the last census to gerrymander its districts. And unless the Dems get serious, same thing's going to happen in 2020. And so, you know, when they say all politics is local, well, the Democrats better figure out that local is going to count. And so that means winning state legislative races so that they have some say in determining the congressional districts. And it's just going to require, I think, some real investment in people and money if we want to have a two-party system. Because right now, I mean, look at what we have in this state. We have a single-party government. And granted, my proclivities lean more towards Democrats, but two parties isn't bad. They sort of keep each other in check, and we don't have that.
We got to have the strongest two-party system we can.
Right.
We have to make the bigger to make this really viable.
Right, and you want that kind of that kind of discussion of issues, and you want the give and take, and the compromise probably works best for all of us. And we don't have that now. So the it's not going to change in this election. And whether Gilbert really did it, she wasn't even around before she gave up. I mean, how many times did we see her in Lansing, which has got to be a market where she could raise money and build support, get volunteers? I mean, this was a place where this is the core of the Democratic Party in this district.
I see a potential theme emerging for the 2016 campaigns, hopeless campaigns. How many hopeless campaigns are we going to see in November of 2016? I'll just leave it at that.
We'll come back and talk about that.
Okay. Mickey Hurton is the associate publisher of the City Pulse. He also writes for the Greater Lansing Business Monthly. Always great to have you on the show, Mickey. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
Coming up on Current State, we'll open the door to the Barn Theater in Augusta, currently celebrating its 70th season. Plus, we'll hear from the actor in the current production who made his stage debut at the Barn when he was just a year old. That's coming up on Current State. Mid-Michigan has warmed its way into mid-June. I can scarcely believe it. Daytime high temperatures have touched 90 several times around the capital city. Is it a hint of things to come for the summer of 2016? WKAR's Peter Wharf checks in with MLive Chief Meteorologist Mark Torregrossa for a quick overview of the weeks and months ahead. By the way, summer officially started right around 6:30 yesterday evening, but Peter and Mark reach much further back to understand the summer setup.
Well, the winter was real deceiving, a real odd winter here in Michigan. Most people would say we didn't get much snow, but if you look at Flint, they were clocked by about 5 or 6 snowstorms and had over 60 inches of snow. Now you get to other parts of the state and the snowfall was half of normal, but December was very wet. And so we didn't have a lot of widespread snowfall, but we did have significant moisture to get us into the spring season. And then if we did have winter in any place, it seemed to come in March and April along with wet weather too. So we actually started the growing season with quite a bit of water in the ground.
So did that leave our agricultural state in good shape then for what's happening now?
It's better than it would have been if it would have been dry, and we're okay right now on subsoil moisture. And one of the things that farmers will always tell you is if you have a dry early part of the year, the plants, the corn and the soybeans, roots are going down deep and searching for water. And that's what helps you out later on in the season versus if they have the easy water up at the surface early in the season, the roots stay up at the surface. And then if you dry out in the summer, then it really starts to affect the crops.
Got it. It seems like we've been dry lately. I know just in my little patch of earth, the south-facing front lawn is going kind of brown. Is that the trend?
It is the trend. And everything that we've seen in the last couple of months pointed toward that probably being the trend at some point, and that is a hotter than normal and drier than normal summer. It still looks like I think that condition builds as we go through the summer, and I'm kind of surprised that we've dried out so early, which makes me concerned that I think as we get to late July and all of August, it has the potential to be quite dry, quite hot around Michigan.
Seems like we started off in the recent days and looking ahead to the next week or two, warmer than average then. So that's what you believe we might be looking at.
Yeah, most certainly. This is a whole different weather pattern than what we've had the last 3 years. The last 3 years have been generally cooler than normal, generally abundant to almost too much rainfall. And now the El Nino has ended. La Nina is forming. And when El Nino goes to La Nina, there's a pretty strong correlation to Michigan and the middle part of the country drying out as we head into summer and even lasts into fall.
That's a great explanation. Mark Torregrossa is chief meteorologist for MLive. We're talking to him here on Current State. Can we talk lakes a little bit? What are lake levels looking like? Great Lakes.
Lake levels, most of them are up a little bit from last year. And, of course, last year they were up quite a bit from the year before, and the year before that they were up quite a bit. So the lake levels are over 2 feet higher than what they were 3 or 4 years ago when they were almost or at record lows. So lake levels are holding steady. Now with this dry weather, we might start to see them inch downward a touch, but it would take several seasons of dry weather before we'd start to see the lake levels fall back off some.
Well, maybe we're looking to a warmer and drier summer, but perhaps the good side of that is lake temperatures and beach time, maybe. How's that looking?
Definitely. Again, a totally different weather pattern than the last 3 years. Last 3 years, you were out on your boat or at the beach with a sweatshirt on many times. We have a pontoon boat on Duck Lake by Interlaken.
Nice.
We've already been out, I think I told my wife this past weekend, we've been out 4 weekends already. And this past weekend, we were out on the water, and I think it was warmer than any weekend last summer, and certainly warmer than any week the summer before. And look at the calendar. We're only in middle of June with the heat building. So I think as we go through July and August, you're going to want to find a good beach or a good lake to swim in here in Michigan.
Yeah, if you like your beach and boat weather, it's looking pretty good. Mark Torregrossa is chief meteorologist for MLive. Taking a look ahead to summer of 2016. Thanks a lot, Mark.
You're welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
The temperature's about 88. Hopping the water plug, just for old time's sake. Break to your crib, change your clothes once more, because you're invited to a barbecue to start with four. Sitting with your friends, as y'all reminisce about the days growing up.
And coming up on Current State, a study conducted in a remote area connecting Michigan and Wisconsin is shedding light on connections between the animal and plant worlds. We'll talk with a researcher from the University of Notre Dame and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources to find out what they learned from that study. That and more after the break.
It's time to cruise, so you go to the summertime, hang out, it looks like a car show. Everybody come looking real fine, fresh from the barbershop, a fly from the beauty salon.
We're going to hear some storytelling before the hour is through from our last pop-up stories event, and this is kind of in anticipation of our next event, which is 1 week from tomorrow night at the Allen Marketplace. We hope you can join us between 5:30 and 7 to listen to other people's stories. We've still got room for a few more storytellers, as it turns out. The storytelling theme is putting down roots 1 week from tomorrow night. We'll have a sample here for you to listen to from our last session coming up here before the end of the hour. There's a great tradition in the theater world, summer stock, which is to say a theater that takes advantage of the mostly good weather to stage productions. It can also provide young or just graduated performers a chance to watch seasoned colleagues and learn what makes up the core repertoire of theater life. One of these summer stock theaters is located here in mid-Michigan and has just begun its 70th season. Current State's Jamie Paisley visited the Barn Theater School in Augusta this past weekend. Just as the cast and crew were ready to change from one production into the next one, the classic from 1950, Guys and Dolls. I'm guessing you saw plenty of action down there, Jamie?
Well, I mean, not gambling action, but that happens certainly in Guys and Dolls. There are plenty of things that the Barneys, that's to say the core performers and stagehands of the Barn Theater, lots of tasks that the Barneys are responsible for. Cleaning up the grounds, painting of the sets, and someone has the inevitable and unenviable cleaning of the restrooms duty, so to speak. It's been that way since the early days of the Barn Theater, and it also includes Penelope Ragazzi as well, who, with her husband Brendan, co-owns the Barn Theater. Penelope is also the public relations manager, the intern wrangler, and the paperwork guru. It's also worth noting that for the entirety of these past 70 seasons, the Barn Theater has been fairly family-owned.
Oh, not fairly. It's family-owned. Yeah, family-run the whole time. My in-laws started it in 46 in Richland, and then when those town elders decided that it was too much traffic in 1949, they said, no, you can't do this anymore. And then my father-in-law and mother-in-law were just kind of panicked with where to be, where to go, and they were just looking around the area, and someone pointed out the Cook Barn, and it was this. So they had their first season in 1949 here at the theater, and we have all these, speaking of amazing pictures, of people, there's one right over there, where they're literally, you know, you see horses everywhere. I mean, it's very rustic, and people just sort of dug in and did what they needed to do, and we keep building on that and building on it, and that's one thing we pride ourselves on. If there's any money that's made, we put it right back into the place, you know, because it always needs something, you know, because she's an old building, and it's wood, you know, So it's had to be steel reinforced, and it's a special design that has got us on the Historic Landmark Society, where barns are typically six-sided, five-sided, whereas this is completely, the beams are just bent. It's a completely round top, you know, if you will, roof, and that's sort of rare. And, yeah, there's always something that needs to be done, so our money goes right back into the place.
So this was started by the in-laws, and then when did your association with the barn start?
It started in 1986, so this is my 30th year. Yeah, so it's a long time, yeah. And I think that's one of those things, just sort of before you realize it, you're like, oh my gosh, I've been here for a really long time. Oh my. And, you know, you've just sort of picked up perhaps knowledge along the way. As much as I don't know everything by any means, how to run the place or anything, but you just sort of, you dabble in everything. The love for the theater is just right there in all those jobs that you've done, and you have so much pride in what you do on stage as well as off. And, you know, that's a thing that Brendan and I, my in-laws as well, tried to do, if you will. You try to turn out a better person and performer at the same time as you're, you know, making them work 17-hour days.
Give a holler and hate me, go ahead, hate me.
The mischief of my life I was a fool to give to you.
All right, already, I'm just a no-goodnik. All right, already, it's true. So new, so sue me, what can you do me? I love you.
You gamble it here, you gamble it
here. Hi, I'm Robin Haynes. I am playing Nathan Detroit in Guys and Dolls.
Now, the show, it's very interestingly framed. They stick to the formula very well of having two different couples and split fairly evenly between the romantic side and your side, which is fairly comedic. Were you voted class clown or something like that?
No, not at all. But once I got out of school and started working as an actor, that's absolutely the kind of roles I always played. I was always the comic lead. I never got the girl. But this time I get the girl and I get to be the comic lead. I get all the laughs and get the girl too, so it works out very well for me.
How long have you been with the barn?
I hate to say how long it's been because that would give away my age, but my first year here was 1954.
Oh, wow.
Do you
remember what the first production was?
I don't know. Jack Ragazzi carried me on for his curtain speech on my first birthday because my mom and dad were working here. My mom's still is associated with the barn all these years later.
Now, since Robin Haynes is a guest performer during this production of Guys and Dolls during this season at the Barn Theater, he's excused from the typical Barney or core member duties across the grounds. However, since his relationship with the Barn Theater and the Ragazzi family goes back for decades, I did have to ask Robin, what was the worst Barney job that he remembered?
Liming the outhouse.
Liming the outhouse. I have no idea even what that means.
Well, you know, there are outhouses up on the hill, and you have to put the poop-eating lime in there to keep them, in working order.
Poop-eating lime, that's a theater term as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Technical talk, yeah. Being here is hard work, but it's also great, you know, and one of the functions that it serves is that it kind of winnows out the people. I mean, it kind of divides the people who love it and the people who don't. And if you love it, then nothing's onerous, you know. Yeah, you know, you may go, God, I don't want to do this anymore, but then, you know, I get to do a show tonight. So it's okay.
For the people all said beware, all said you're beware. On a heavenly trip. People all said beware, all said beware. You'll scuttle a ship, and the devil will drag you under. By the fancy tie run, you will get your own. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down. You're rocking the boat down.
I'm Brooke Evans, and I'm playing Miss Adelaide in Guys and Dolls.
And you are not excused from Barney activities.
Oh, most definitely not. No, I am the bar manager.
So after the performance, people are invited also to the rehearsal shed. And so when you're finished with Miss Adelaide, you then are managing the bar in the rehearsal shed as well?
Yes, I am. I come down, I get everybody seated and situated, and then I jump behind the bar and start pouring drinks and occasionally run lights and, you know, keep everything moving and then close up the bar.
And in the center, there's also the piano. Are you also then invited to sing during the afterglow as well?
It has been known to happen, not in this particular bar show, but yeah, from time to time.
There are moments that a lot of people don't see behind the scenes, and is there something that's kind of stuck out for the years that's kept bringing you back?
Well, you know, the beautiful thing about this theater is its history, and the people who began this theater, the people who have been seeing it through all these years, and last year I was working in the archival room, and I was just kind of in awe of the fact that I was looking at photo albums from 1946, and I was looking at pictures of actors that I have worked with. And I just think that's the most amazing thing. I mean, it's such a rarity anymore in the theater world. This is such a gem. And, it's not a particularly funny anecdote, but it really is what I love most about this theater. That's what brings me back.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight.
Co-owner of the Barn Theater School, Penelope Orgazzi, also is proud of the Barn's Backstage Experience, a free program for youths K-12 who are interested in theater.
And what they do is partake in about an hour's worth of classes, which it turns out to be 12 to 15 maybe minute classes. And they'll learn all that went into, as much as they can, actually went into the show that they're about to see. They're going to learn some choreography up in the lobby, which is just wonderful. And then they'll see it right there on stage when they're watching the show. So it's very, very cool. And that's one of the most interactive moments, of course. And then they'll learn how lighting affects the mood of a show and how the scenery and lighting must work together and how costumes. Obviously, if someone's in black and then lights are dark, you know, it evokes a certain feeling from the audience. And the kids are learning how everything works together, and it's a huge community. And it takes all of these people who are very, very good at their job to bring what they know, and the show gets done because of all the hands working together.
More information about the Barn Theater's Backstage Experience, the musicals being performed for this 70th season, including the classic Guys and Dolls, which opens tonight and runs for 2 weeks, is available at barntheaterschool.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. A recent study conducted in a remote area connecting Michigan and Wisconsin is shedding light on connections between the animal and plant worlds. Researchers from the University of Notre Dame and the Michigan Department of Natural Resources just released findings from a study involving something they call trophic cascades. That mysterious phrase refers to the impacts that predators, in this case wolves, have on their prey, in this case deer. And that, in turn, has an impact on plant life. In simplest terms, the study suggests that deer tend to avoid areas where wolves are prevalent, thereby enabling the plants that the deer eat to survive. It's a simple enough concept, but one with ramifications we will learn more about from one of the study's co-authors. Dr. Gary Bolovsky specializes in conservation and population biology at Notre Dame. He joins us by phone in Montana, where he's working near the National Bison Range. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
Let's look at, let's jump ahead to one of this takeaway from this study. It appears that the key one is that wolves play a role in allowing some species of plants to survive and possibly to thrive. Can you help us understand the dynamic, please?
Well, there's two ways that this can happen. One is if the wolves kill enough of the herbivores, the consumption of the plants by the herbivores goes down, in this case the white-tailed deer. The other way that this can happen is if the wolves change the feeding behavior of the white-tailed deer, that can also reduce the consumption and affect the populations of the plants. So one of the interesting things about our study this time is that what we're finding is that the actual killing effects of the wolves on the white-tailed deer is far less important than the effect of the wolves changing the feeding behavior of the deer.
Hmm. So they're not killing them necessarily, but the deer are altering their behavior?
Yes, well, they are killing some, of course. And the killing of the deer creates a sense of fear in the deer so that they are now more alert to looking for wolves in the environment, move out of areas where you have lots of wolves or more wolves present, and they're basically more vigilant, they're more cautious, and this is changing their feeding behavior.
And this defines a process with this rather mysterious name, trophic cascades. Is this like a domino effect?
In essence, it is. What's happening is that in a trophic system, you have the plants, you have the herbivore feeding on the plants, and you have the wolves eating the herbivore, the white-tailed deer in this case. And the net effect is that by the wolves acting on the behavior or the feeding behavior of the deer, it has a ripple effect on the population dynamics, the survivorship of the plants.
This all seems so basic. Does this represent something new, or does it upset some other existing theory?
It's not that it reflects something new. There's several novel elements that are involved in our study. One is our showing that the change in behavior is the main driving factor in this case, rather than the direct elimination of deer from the system by killing. The other thing that's important in our system, in what we're looking at here, is that a number of studies have tried to look for these trophic cascades. Sometimes they find them, sometimes they don't find them. Our study is one of the first that clearly and experimentally, because we did it through experiments, demonstrates the trophic cascade. The importance of this is, can we start to answer why you see trophic cascades under some cases and you don't see trophic cascades under other.
Hmm. What does this mean, if anything, for areas where plants or other flora are being destroyed by deer? Are those connected? Will this solve some kind of problem?
Well, there's certainly a management implication to this. If you are in an ecosystem where trophic cascades are expected to take place, once I fully identify what the conditions are that lead to trophic cascades, if you're in one of those areas, then you could use the recolonization of wolves into an area to impact the forest regeneration that takes place. I think one of the important things here is that by bringing wolves into the system, you are going to increase the survivorship and the abundance of some plants. But on the other hand, you might see other plants diminish in abundance, as those might be the ones that would flourish when deer are feeding a lot in the forest.
Hmm. Dr. Gary Bilofsky is a biologist at the University of Notre Dame. We're learning about the results of a study that was conducted in Michigan and Wisconsin involving carnivores, herbivores, and plant life. It appears in the journal Community Ecology. I'm really intrigued by where you conducted this study. I know it took place in areas along the border of Michigan and Wisconsin in the UP. Where exactly were you?
We did the work at the University of Notre Dame Environmental Research Center, which is on the border of Wisconsin and the UP of Michigan, and that I'm the director of it.
And how exactly did you conduct the study? What did you do?
Well, that is one of the really important aspects of this study. Rather than being observational, going into an area and just seeing what wolves do with their prey, we actually conducted an experiment where the forest was broken down into areas where there were lots of wolves because it was in their territory, and in other areas where there were fewer wolves because it was outside their territories or on the border of their territory. And then we built exclosures there, which exclude the deer, and then we compared how the forest grew in the exclosure without deer present and outside the exclosure with deer present.
How interesting. Let me try to connect some historical dots here. I mean, we saw the near disappearance of gray wolves in Michigan by, I want to say, the late 1950s, I believe. But in recent decades, we've seen a resurgence. I take it that when the wolves disappeared, there was a corresponding surge in the deer population because they lost a predator. Is that accurate?
That could be possible, that when the wolves disappeared by the 1950s, that the deer increased because of the lack of predation. But I want to, as a scientist, I need to caution on this point. That connection of dots has often been made. However, we also have a number of studies that have shown that deer may go up with the removal of wolves and mountain lion predators, but the other things are going on in the environment, such as changes in land use, recovery after of intensive forestry or grazing. And when we do these observational studies like this, it's hard to identify directly the cause and effect. There are other things often going on that may complicate things.
That is
so,
what?
Yes, that seems likely, but we can't be certain that that is the sole cause of what we saw.
Yet another reason I did not become a scientist there. What kind of plants do white-tailed deer consume?
Well, they consume a wide variety of the herbaceous plants that grow on the forest floor, as well as a number of the saplings in particular, as they're regenerating to go back into the forest canopy, growing up into the forest canopy. Some of the species the deer will eat, and others they avoid. We're seeing in particular that the sugar maple and the red maples are recovering, are growing much better in the areas that the deer have been excluded from.
Let me, we've got less than a minute, Dr. Bilofsky. Let me ask you what you're doing at the National Bison Range. I'm not even sure I knew there was a National Bison Range until I arranged this interview. What are you doing out there in Montana?
Well, the National Bison Range is a very important conservation area. It's the place that they brought bison back from near extinction in the early 1900s under the leadership of Teddy Roosevelt. What we've been studying here since 1978 is basically trophic cascade type effects. We started working on herbivore feeding behavior with bison, elk, bighorn, sheep, all the way down to grasshoppers. And now we're looking at these trophic cascade effects, primarily doing experiments with grasshoppers and birds.
Hmm. Very interesting. What a great place, great part of the world to be doing your work. We want to thank Gary Bilofsky, who is on the faculty at the University of Notre Dame. He specializes in conservation and population biology. We've been talking about a recent study with Notre Dame and the DNR involving so-called trophic cascades. Dr. Bilofsky, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And this environmental segment of Current State, supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news of the Great Lakes environment, check out greatlakesecho.org. We'll be right back. Let's listen to a story. We're going to take you back to Current State's last pop-up stories session. The live storytelling event took place at the Robin Theater in Rio Town, Lansing last month, and the theme was the birds and the bees. Volunteer storytellers shared their true first-person stories on that theme. We're going to listen here to Jay Wager's story about a high school sweetheart.
High school can be a difficult time, and on the first day of high school, it was very traumatic for me. I was very shy and very socially ill prepared, and got to fifth hour, and we had study hall, and I had to sit at this table with a guy and three young women, three attractive young women, and I'd never really had a meaningful conversation with a girl, and they were trapped. They had to be there every day. And so one of them had long brown hair down to her waist, and I decided that, you know, a little practice here, we're talking with girls, that I was going to ask her out. And I finally did that. It was a year later. I was a sophomore, and I finally got up the courage to ask her for a date. And I liked to roller skate. I knew that she liked to roller skate. And every month, churches in the area where I lived rented the skating rink for a night. And so I figured that was a safe venue. So I said, hey, would you like to go roller skating? And she said, no. So that kind of hurt, being a 15-year-old. But I thought, well, we'll try again. So a couple months later, I summoned up all my courage again, and I said, hey, would you like to go on a date? And she said, no. So she still seemed really friendly. You know, we had some classes together, and I thought, well, I don't know. Maybe something here. She's busy. I don't know. So third time, I get up my energy, and it's a Thursday, and I say, would you like to go roller skating on Monday? And she said, yes. And I go, great. And I'm really happy, and Friday, meet her at school, and she says, no. So I figured this just isn't going to go anywhere. And so that was my sophomore year, junior year, senior year. It's about this time of year, near the end of my senior year, and we've never had a date. But we have a friend that's trying to hook us up. So Marty gives us tickets to go to a concert. It was the Navy Band concert band. And I really had no interest in that, but we had the free ticket, so we go that, and we kind of snicker in the back row, and I had an okay time. And afterwards, we went out to dinner and had a nice dinner, and then I had been asked to go to a birthday party, and I asked her, well, Charlotte's birthday party is tonight, and I was asked to come, and I said I would come, and I asked Charlotte if you could come, and she said yes. And we had many common friends, so I thought, but she says, no, you can go, but take me home. Okay, so I took her home. And then we graduate, and we go away to different colleges in different cities, and after our freshman year of college, we come home, and this whole time through high school, we only live about three blocks apart. So I would, you know, walk down the street and kind of walk by her house, and sometimes she'd be walking her dog, usually with her sisters, but I'd walk for a while. And also her house, the back of her lot, bordered the tennis courts. So sometimes I'd go play tennis, and I'd try and get in the court where I could look in her backyard and see if she was out. And, you know, sometimes the birds and the bees, they just fly slowly. But through this summer, after our freshman year of high school, we began to date. And we did that for quite a while. And, of course, the first time I tried to kiss her, she said no. But now, after 41 years, four children, and three grandchildren, she's kind of adjusted to me, as best I can tell.
Jay Wager there with his story about his high school sweetheart who became his wife. Join us for more great first-person true storytelling at our next pop-up stories Wednesday, June 29th, 1 week from tomorrow night, Allen Marketplace in Lansing. The theme will be Putting Down Roots. Putting Down Roots. We have room for a few more storytellers at the event. If you'd like to tell one, email us at currentstate@wkar.org or look us up on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. We hope you can join us, whether it's to share a story or just to listen. It's a good time. That's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, Helping Women, Period, is a local nonprofit whose mission is to help ensure that all women have the products they need when they need them. They supply shelters, food banks, homeless organizations with feminine hygiene items. They'll be our guests for Neighbors in Action here tomorrow on Current State. Peter Worf is our executive director. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is a great way to stay on top of what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. Politics, education, music, science, tech, theater, healthcare, you name it. Stories from all around Michigan in your hometown. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. It's just perfect for dog walking. I can't recommend it any more highly. You can stay connected with Current State on Twitter, at KAR Current State, and on Facebook, at Current State from WKAR. Have a wonderful day. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's Current State on WKAR.